I have three short passages for you this morning. The first passage is from the book Waking Up White, which is the book that we're doing as a one town, one book project process this fall. I know that many of you are reading this book already, if you aren't, you're probably hearing people talk about it, and if that isn't true, it's true now. There are several more conversations about this book coming up, and the author is coming in November. I recommend it to you, and I recommend the conversation about it most of all. And then I'll read you two short passages from James Baldwin's The Fire next time. But first, Waking Up White. Debbie Irving says, "Until I became aware of how my internalized ways of thinking and acting interfered with my best intentions to bridge the racial divide, I was like a bull, a white bull in a china shop. What passed for normal in my white world had the potential to alienate people of color. Until I understood this problem, I moved clumsily around people of color, creating unintentional slights, reinforcing the white stereotype, and perpetuating the kind of mistrust and misunderstanding that fuels racism." And these are the words of James Baldwin from his essay and book, The Fire Next Time. This was published in 1963, so some of you may have read it when it first came out. He says, "I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense once the hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain." And he also says, "All of us know, whether or not we are able to admit it, that mirrors can only lie, that death by drowning is all that awaits one there. It is for this reason that love is so desperately sought and so cunningly avoided. Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but in a state of being or a state of grace. Not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. I think our town is engaging in a pretty amazing experience together, choosing to read a book together. It's a pretty big book club. What's the population of our town?
14,000.
It's a big book club. Now, not everyone is reading it at once, but to conceive of it as a conversation that we're having together and to know that even people who aren't reading the book are engaged in the conversation that is happening in our town is an exciting model and reality to be in. So we picked the book Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates a year ago, and then we were sort of turning over how to engage the next book and decided to take on the same area of justice and human relationships from a very different perspective, and that's how we ended up reading Waking Up White. And then I got to thinking about this kind of conversation that's happening. What is it like for us to have a collective conversation with national writers. And then I realized that when Ta-Nehisi Coates was starting to write his book, Between the World and Me, he had been reading James Baldwin, reading The Fire Next Time, and that, in fact, he had modeled his book, Between the World and Me, on James Baldwin's essay. Both books are addressed to a younger family member. Baldwin's is addressed to his nephew, and Coates' book is addressed to his son. So the books themselves are conversations, relationships, ways of thinking through reality together. So I went back recently to my old copy of James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time, which was underlined in blue colored pencil. That's what I had when I was reading it in college. And I discovered that the underlining was no help to me because I'd underlined the whole darn thing. But I did find that line at the end that I've put out as the title for today, What Will Happen to All That Beauty? Baldwin is aware through the whole essay, and in that question, I feel like he just catches it in a particularly poignant way. He's aware that the tension, that the misunderstanding, that the violence between, he's talking mostly about white people and African American people, is so difficult and so potentially explosive that if it's not dealt with, it could explode and cause tremendous damage. Not only physically to people, that a lot of people could be hurt, but to the fabric of our society. He was writing about that in 1963, and you know what was unfolding and continued to unfold. And in some ways, we are there again, at a point that the tension and the violence between the races is so acute that you can feel that the stakes are tremendously high and that it's very hard to figure out what's the next step that will move us toward being able to have a conversation among all of us in this country. So the fact that we are engaging in a conversation, I think, is a bigger deal than it might feel like if you are just reading this book and maybe you've planned to attend one of our conversations or maybe you've already gotten to go to one. I think that just engaging the possibility is something that is both difficult to do and that most people don't do because I think, as Baldwin says, we're aware of the pain that waits us. And it's hard to step toward things that you know will be painful, whether it's your own inner pain or the pain that we encounter when we have real conversations with each other. The last time we had an all-town read, one of the things that came out of it was that one of the members of our congregation attended the Citizens Police Academy in order to understand the relationship between police and community and begin to think about that question in our town. 14,000, not the biggest metropolis that's grappling with that question, and yet this is where we are. This is where we grapple with these questions for ourselves. So that's another conversation that got started and is ongoing, and that I think we'll get to eavesdrop on a little bit. So we're having all kinds of kind of quiet conversations. And if you've read some of this book, you know that Debbie Irving, who wrote it, is, she says on the back, her awakening could not have happened to a whiter person. She's New England, Protestant, white, probably upper middle class, some of the most privileged background that's out there. And so if you read this and you aren't Protestant background or aren't New England background or aren't middle class background, you may have tilted your head a little bit and tried to understand what she was working on or why she didn't understand some of the things that she had to wake up to in her 40s, which just indicates that we are, in addition to trying to have a conversation about race, we are trying to simultaneously have a conversation with our Protestant ancestors. And as you may know, I'm a fan of fighting with some of our particularly Protestant ancestors who are long dead and no longer in the room to defend themselves. And I have tended to blame them for, you know, everything that's wrong in the world. And part of what I have had to do as I've been reading Waking Up White is not just push away that ancestry, not just try to reject it. It sounds like something that happens when you're a teenager, doesn't it? But remember that these are my people. I'm also of Protestant heritage, and this is part of who I am, and their story is my story, and I get to live with that as my story and not just keep talking about how bad I think they were back then. Which is not to say that they didn't do some things that have played out in just terrible ways in our country. But what I've learned from Waking Up White and from having these conversations is that we have to name it and claim it as our own and not always keep it at a distance. And once I take it in, I can begin to live with it in a different way. Begin to tell the story as the story of our country instead of something that somebody did. And I think that's part of what it means to be white, to own that part of being white. And stay in the conversation with the Protestant heritage and the Catholic heritage, and the Muslim heritage, and Hindu heritage, and Native American heritage, for us all to understand the history that we come from and how we inhabit our world now. So we're having these conversations. I met with just a few people last week to have a conversation about Waking Up White, and it was our little circle, and then all of the circles of the religious backgrounds in the room and the class backgrounds in the room and the gender of the people in the conversation and people in other places who are having these very same conversations. And the book Waking Up White is in conversation with the book Between the World and Me, because Ta-Nehisi Coates is asking white people to notice that they're living with some illusions. And Between the World and Me is a conversation with a fire next time. So when we sit together and talk about this book, or when you read this book, you're in a conversation with James Baldwin, all at the same time. It's a rich and complicated conversation we are having. And I think we can only engage in that conversation, can only stay present for it, if we remember that we're having conversations about love. It's not about fixing it or getting it right or knowing what's next, but about living into that kind of love that Baldwin tries to describe, not merely in a personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace, not in an infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. Two weeks ago, I talked about shame, about the fear that one is not worthy of connection. And the antidote to that is this kind of love, this love that is bigger than each one of us, the kind of love that is quest and daring and growth. It is the insistence that we are not alone, whether it is as individuals or as a congregation. And it is the love which is about figuring out how to act in the world in some way. A friend of mine from seminary wrote this week. She said, "I am quitting politics and joining civics. I am quitting division and joining discourse. I am quitting political parties and joining people. I am quitting countries and conflicts and joining community. I am quitting racial division and joining racial diversity. I am quitting religion and joining God." And in seminary, we were always translating for each other, and I always translated God to love. That tough, universal kind of love, that questing kind of love. James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates quit all of these things too, including the rich religious life of the African-American community, because they felt that that religion sometimes allowed people to settle for what is, to settle for oppression. And they couldn't settle for that. They wanted people to break out of those masked lives. And here we are. Unitarian Universalists, I think, always are struggling a little bit with quitting religion, with figuring out how to live into it in a way that is deep and real and also mundane. And it is absolutely our religious heritage to live into that transformative kind of love. One of the quotes that we have had from time to time out on the front of our church is from Francis David. The words that we put out there are, "We need not think alike to love alike." But the thing that you may not remember about Francis David, whose name I am saying in a very Americanized way because he's Hungarian or Czech, I can't remember now, looking to the back row for the historian. I'll have to get back to you next week about where exactly he started his life, because he moved through Europe in the 1500s. And arrived in what was Transylvania at the time, where they were experimenting with religious diversity. They had gathered in Transylvania many different religions and announced that these religions could live together in peace, that the conversation among the religions should continue instead of one religion being right and others being persecuted. And Francis David was part of that proclamation and insistence on the possibility of the conversation among different lives. And the reality is that our social construction right now means that we are trying to figure out how to live into a different conversation in our country. We believe that we need not think alike to love alike, and yet it's hard to live into that. It is still true that Sunday morning is the most segregated hour of the day, of the week. Well, my seminary friend went on to say that she made some muffins and took them over to her neighbor, who was displaying a sign for a candidate with whom she does not agree. So I'm going to try that in my personal experiment. A few weeks ago, I said that I was trying to make contact with a neighbor who had a similar situation, and I've, of course, now I haven't seen him in 2 or 3 weeks. Literally haven't seen the man. So I'm gonna try the baking angle. And it seems small, although it's interesting to me how hard it is to actually make that contact, which suggests to me that it's not as small as I think it is to actually try to make contact. And that making contact, that engaging a conversation, is so contrary to what is happening in our country right now, that any little act of contact and conversation is a little bit of rebellion, a little bit of asserting that huge love in small, mundane ways. And whenever I start thinking about this stuff, I start thinking about making mistakes. Debbie Irving talks about it a lot in her book, and it's one of the inheritances of Protestant culture that we hesitate sometimes to do things because we fear that we will do it wrong. And I'm pretty sure that the only way to take on these conversations that seem unmovable is to just blunder in and make a bunch of mistakes and then have a conversation about the mistakes. So we have to be willing to stay in there when we feel ashamed and when other people feel ashamed, which is to say fear of not being worthy of connection. Because as I make more and more mistakes in my life, I notice that those open up opportunities to show people how much I love them. And it's a little less comfortable, but it's really better. And that's when we have a chance to save all this beauty. This is the awakening that Debbie Irving describes in her book. This is how we take off that mask that white people wear. Be good, be correct. And protect yourself from shame and miss the beauty. So I don't have any better answer to any of this than that. Try to make contact maybe with muffins. Blunder into conversations and stay in it even though it's uncomfortable. And I know that after this election, we will have to do a lot of that in this country. That our society has been pretty profoundly stressed, and that we will have to do a lot of work on race, on class, on gender, on just loving each other. It will take more than muffins over the garden fence for sure. And I hope that we can invent ways to have an ongoing conversation about how we take off the masks that protect us and how we go out into the world with our tender hearts and our unexpected love. It isn't safe, that's for sure. But none of this really is.